The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Having this transformation in the future, that's what strategy is. It's figuring out actions now that have, in which the environment of those actions are sufficiently predictable, understandable, that we can anticipate that these strategies actually enhance the capacity to transform something in the future. It's a pretty bold idea, really, to think about strategy. In sociology, there's this quip that I think Theda Scotchpole made in her book in the late 70s on revolution, in which she said, revolutions happen, they're not made. Which is basically a rejection of the idea that you can have a strategy. They happened. If it hadn't been for the First World War, there would have been no Bolshevik Revolution. And the Bolsheviks had no strategy to create the First World War. Right? You know? Well, I think you can have a strategy. And I think socialists and anti-capitalists have had strategic thinking. What I want to do, here's my strategy for the presentation. I'm going to lay out a menu. This is a kind of logical structure of the field of anti-capitalist strategies. It's, of course, stylized. These kinds of two-by-two tables, that's one of the favorite tools of sociologists. You know, I like to tell students if they come to me with a list of three of something, I ask, what's the fourth? And it's, of course, it's a kind of glib question to ask, because sometimes there may just be three. But typically, when you have a set of categories and you have three of them, there's probably some lurking underlying dimensionality to it. It's not just three different things. It's three things that fit into some kind of conceptual order. And one type of conceptual order is that there's underlying dimensions in which there's a fourth missing type. Indeed, in my work on this problem about strategic logics of anti-capitalism, I initially did just have a list of three. And then when I started to write the book, I asked myself the question I asked my students. And I realized, yes, there actually was a fourth category. And then in thinking about that, it really did transform the way I thought about the initial three as well. So this is a device, of course. Okay, so what I'm going to do is map out these four categories, show how actual historical movements combine them. So these are not mutually exclusive. These are strategic logics that can be packaged in different ways. And that historically, different kinds of movements may be anchored in one or another of these, but they combine them in different ways. And then I'm going to propose a way of thinking about the particular form of combination, how these strategic logics fit together in the present era, whatever we mean by that, how we should think about it for the future. All right, so let me lay out this roadmap, this menu. Strategies can be distinguished along these two dimensions. What is the fundamental goal of the strategy? And what's the locus of the strategy, its targets? The goals of strategy can be thought of as trying to transcend the structures of capitalism, go beyond them to create something new, or to neutralize the harms of capitalism. Of course, neutralizing the harms could segue into transcending. If you neutralize the harms sufficiently, the way you go about doing that may actually end up transcending the structures, so that could still, these could be connected. But this is the primary purpose to neutralize the harms or transcend the structure. And is the primary locus of the strategy the state? Is that the target? The action is directed at the state? Or in what I'm treating in a very loose and encompassing way, not a kind of narrow technical way, not the non-state. Let's call it civil society. I'm not using that in this sort of narrow sense of that some people do. So I'm just treating this as a way of talking about the dimension. Okay, so one strategic logic treats the state as the primary locus of strategy, and transcending structures as the primary goal of strategy. I call that smashing capitalism. Now, technically, revolutionaries who have adopted this strategic thinking talk about smashing the state, not smashing capitalism. And I have been criticized for talking about smashing capitalism. It's really smashing the state in order to fundamentally transform the economic structure so as to destroy capitalism, et cetera. I'm going to say, as a shorthand for all that, smashing capitalism. This is the classical idea of revolutionary Marxism, communism, the revolutionary movements we saw in the 20th century. The strategic vision is that in order to go beyond capitalism, it's necessary to seize the centers of power through which social systems are reproduced. The state is the target, basically because the state is seen as the central site where power relations in the class structure are sustained and reproduced. But you can't simply seize the state, because the state itself is built in such a way that its very form reproduces capitalism. So you have to seize the state. The first order of business is to transform the state itself to make it a suitable weapon, instrument, for then transforming the economic structure. We can think of this as a ruptural strategy because it imagines a real break, an historical break. There is, to overstate it, a before and after. You know, the joke is, what are you going to do on the morning after the revolution, right? So it's you can think of it as smash first, build second. Again, a caricature, but it really suggests that the main task of building the new society comes after you have a rupture, not before. It's not that you build a new society inside the old, and then the rupture is just the coup de grace that just allows for the unbottling of what you've already built. No, the idea of the ruptural strategy of smashing capitalism is that it's a precondition to fundamentally transform class relations, that you see state power, transform the state, and then destroy the centers of power in the old system. Taming capitalism in much of the 20th century was the main rival among anti-capitalists. It was associated with what we could call left social democracy, I suppose. I mean, the term social democracy has gotten deformed by its historical evolution so that it no longer really is even anti-capitalist in many of its incarnations. Certainly in its historical forms and in its most vibrant periods, there were very strong anti-capitalist tendencies, arguments, beliefs, sharing much of the same critique of capitalism. Much of the same critique of capitalism was held by the smashing capitalism logics and the taming capitalism logics. But there was a different assessment as to what was possible, what was achievable, what there was the political capacity to even imagine having a strategy about. So people who have argued for taming capitalism, that is, neutralizing its harms, creating counter-institutions, particularly centered at the state, that could seriously neutralize the worst harms of capitalism. They believed that that was something that you could have a strategy about. But you couldn't have a strategy about transcending capitalism. Once you neutralized its harms, then you could begin to worry about, well, how could we go beyond that? In Sweden, in fact, in the 1970s, there was this proposal, which I think many of you know about, called the Meidner Plan. Very interesting, incredibly smart and clever idea, which ultimately was defeated, about how you could have the Swedish working class buy out Swedish capitalism. That you would basically, over a 40 or 50 year period, transfer property rights from capital to labor. And the idea was, it's still incredibly clever, the idea is that you have corporate income taxes, profits taxes paid in shares rather than in cash. So you have a 10% profit tax, you evaluate what it is in kroner, but you have to pay for it in shares in the company rather than in cash. What does that mean? It's really clever because it means it doesn't affect the profit rate. So capital, the corporation still has as much to invest, but it dilutes ownership a little bit every tax period. you have to issue new shares. The shares go into something called the wage earners funds that are controlled by unions. And over a 40-year period, all Swedish corporations become majority owned by the unions. Right? Well, the bourgeoisie in Sweden really got it. They got it, and they had this relentless attack on the proposal. They called it the Bolshevik Revolution Comes to Sweden. I mean, it was just no holds barred, and the Social Democrats lost their first election as a result of it. You know, it was an absolute offensive by the Swedish capitalist class against that. But it's a fantastic idea. I mean, you can see how it's the culmination of a reformist view about how you can tame capitalism, solve problems within capitalism, neutralize its harms in such a way that it also ultimately transcends capitalism. But the political opposition was too great. I don't think the lesson from that, by the way, is therefore that shows once again that it's impossible. It just shows that in those historical conditions it wasn't possible. Okay, that's taming capitalism. Resisting capitalism. That's what lots of the labor movement has really done. It's about how can we neutralize some of the harms, particularly at the point of production in the workplace and the labor market. How can we neutralize those harms by getting enough power to be able to impose costs on capital unless they form compromises? So it's a kind of class struggle at the economic level in civil society, and it extends beyond just the workplace. Much of the environmental movement has that character, you know, opposing toxic dumps and other depredations. It's neutralizing harms directed at targets that are not primarily the state. Resisting capitalism also, of course, takes the kind of mundane forms that are at the heart of every social history of capitalism within the workplace itself. Workers in their micro-solidarities within work resisting bosses and unfair treatment in all sorts of ways. That's neutralizing harms, not trying to transcend the structures, and it's not primarily targeted at the state. It's targeted at class actors especially, but other actors of power in civil society. And finally, there is what can be called escaping capitalism. Escaping capitalism is as old as capitalism itself. It can take the form of people moving to the western frontier in the United States to become subsistence smallholder farmers. What was the western movement of farmers to the Midwest and then further the Great Plains? They weren't moving west to set up agribusiness. They were largely escaping the market. They would sell their surplus when they had it, but mostly they were wanting to be subsistence producers. And that's really escaping capitalism. The formation of worker cooperatives is another example. That's escaping capitalism, but not escaping the market. Now, I make a distinction between capitalism and the market. Not everybody likes that distinction. Some people want to equate capitalism basically with markets, whereas I think markets in some sense or other will be an essential feature for any complex economic structure in the foreseeable future, and the question is what kinds of power relations are organized within markets rather than whether you have markets or not. The worker cooperatives transform the power relations within the firms that populate a market, but they still compete in a market, but they do so under different conditions in different ways. So worker cooperatives are also an example of escaping capitalism, not escaping the market, but escaping capitalism. The hippie communes, you know, in the 1960s, tune in, turn on, drop out. They were dropping out not just of mainstream culture, they were dropping out of the rat race of the capitalist market, an attempt to basically be like homesteaders. You know, the hippie commune in the woods was meant to be a self, to the extent possible, a self-provisioning livelihood that was as little engaged in the market as possible. In American history, you know, there are some successful examples of escaping, pretty much escaping capitalism, at least bringing the connections to a very thin set of connections that have been reproducible intergenerationally. If you look at the Amish in places where they have a high density, the Amish communities, their cash income per family per year is puts them way, way below the poverty line. But they live well. But they're disconnected from the system. They're off the grid. They have horse and buggies. They do everything, and their choice as to which technologies to use and which not, if you look carefully at those decisions, they have to do with which ways of disconnecting give us autonomy and ability to reproduce ourselves outside of the cash economy and which don't. That's why they want to be off the grid, and that's why they don't want cars. They do have some modern, you know, they'll use modern hand tools. That is, when they get enough cash to be able to buy a tool, they'll have no hesitation getting a good tool. Any rate, that's escaping capitalism. Okay, these are the four, what I would call, primary strategic forms, and then they get combined in different ways. The communist movement in the 20th century, I would argue, combines resisting capitalism and smashing capitalism. The reason why communists played such a big role in labor movements was not simply because they felt that the base for the revolution was the working class, but they felt that ongoing day-to-day struggles within the working class was part of the work of building the necessary movement to be able to smash capitalism. That there was a real connection between sharp struggles of resistance, which were not directed at the state, and the possibility of eventually having a collective capacity to challenge the state itself. Social democracy and the labor movement, in their most vibrant periods, combined taming capitalism with resisting capitalism. And one diagnosis for why social democracy lost steam and then drifted into a non-anti-capitalist posture was the breakdown of its connection to resisting capitalism. You know, it was that connection between the resistance that was built into the day-to-day life and struggles within workplaces to the political movement. It was that connection which kept the political movement honest, in a sense, kept it on the left, kept it as a critical force, even though a critical force of a reformist taming variety. And it's when that connection disintegrates or weakens. I mean, all of these things are in degrees and they come and go. I don't want to turn everything into a binary. But that's really, I think, what is part and parcel of the decay of social democracy as an anti-capitalist force. Social movements in the late 20th and early 21st century, I think, can be thought of as moving from resisting to escaping. Escaping in the sense of actually having a project of building alternatives. You see this more clearly in some places outside of the global north. The landless peasant movement in Brazil, for example, is not primarily directed at the state. From time to time, of course, it gets into conflict with the state and that becomes a target. It's primarily directed at landowners, but they are actually building alternatives. They're not just resisting, they're building new forms of communal relations, both in production and in civil society, their own schools, their own community centers and the like, which are meant to create a prototype of an alternative society, not just an increased capacity of resistance. And that's resisting, combining resisting and escaping. What I think needs to be the strategic configuration for the 21st century, which I call eroding capitalism, combines all three of those. If the social movement logic can be thought of as a kind of anarchist impulse, that is to resist capitalism and build the world you want in the spaces where you can, but ignore the state, work outside the state, try to avoid the state. And social democracy tries to harness the state and connect it to resistance in order to neutralize the harm, stably neutralize the harms of capitalism. Then eroding capitalism, in a sense, is trying to combine some of the intuitions of anarchism and social democracy. You know, it's this sort of odd bedfellows in a way. I mean, anarchists and social democrats have hated each other, you know, almost as much as anarchists have hated communists. I mean, it's really not a comfortable combination. The idea of eroding capitalism says that we need to combine the impulse to actually build now with the need to have a focus on the state to create the conditions under which alternatives can be built. We need both a top-down and bottom-up strategy combined. But note, the smashing capitalism cell is not part of the configuration. Now, in some circles where I discuss this, that seems completely unproblematic. Of course, smashing capitalism shouldn't be part of it. In other circles, the response is, how can you leave out smashing capitalism? Right. Well, it's not that I object to smashing capitalism. You know, if I thought there was a way to smash capitalism, a strategically accessible way, that is, that we could imagine an actual strategy to bring forth that possibility, in which the smashing of capitalism would bring forth the kind of alternative that my values aspire to, then I'd be all for smashing capitalism. You know, the wobbly anthem, Solidarity Forever, it ends with this passionate plea, we will build a new world from the ashes of the old. What more heartfelt plea can you imagine, right? We can build a new world from the ashes from the old. We know how to burn down the old. We've seen that happen on a number of occasions in the 20th century especially. What we don't know how to do is to build the kind of new world we want from ashes. There just is no evidence, there's no empirical evidence that it's possible to build a democratic, egalitarian, solidaristic, and sustainable alternative in the context of smashing the old system. So however much the old system deserves to be smashed, which it does, if that in fact creates conditions under which the alternatives that get built are new forms of domination and despotism, in which the democratic and solidaristic side of transformation are blocked, even if the egalitarian side can be fostered in certain important ways, then I think it is not a viable strategy. So I reject ruptural strategies, and thus the smashing capitalism cell, not on some moral principle that it would be a bad thing to do, or on some abhorrence of the destructive character, you know, the apocalyptic character of the smashing vision. No, it's because I think, in fact, there are good reasons to believe that it doesn't work. It does not produce the consequences that are sought after. And it's not a strategy, therefore. It's a strategy for expressing anger and rage at the system, but not a strategy for creating a democratic, egalitarian, solidaristic alternative. The best we can do, I think, is a strategy that somehow tries to build the alternatives within the world as it exists in such a way that it erodes the basis of reproduction of the dominant system itself. That's why I call it eroding capitalism. Now, this strategic logic implies a certain kind of social theory. It's a certain way of understanding the nature of the social system in which we are struggling for transformation. And while this is a kind of, to really get into this gets into kind of high theory, you know, sort of meta theory about how, what we even mean by system and things like that, I think it's worth just saying a little bit about this and its contrast to an alternative way of thinking about social systems in which eroding really isn't a feasible strategy either. Okay, so this is a little bit of shift from just the more direct discussion of strategy to the logic of systems. I'll give you two stereotyped ways of thinking about a social system. One sees societies kind of like an organism. You can call that an organic system view. It's associated with the word totality. Do you think of society as a totality in which everything fits together into some systemic whole in which the parts, you can talk about the parts serving a function with the whole, and it's integrated, even if it remains contradictory. So even if this is a whole that destabilizes itself, that has internal contradictions, it nevertheless is a totality. And therefore, like any totality, one can study its laws of motion, its dynamics of development. You can have different versions of that. If the organism is like a human being, you can talk about its stages of development, and you can have a theory of its whole trajectory from conception to death. You can theorize the way that system evolves. Or develops, rather. Develops is a better word than evolves for that. Okay, that's the organic system idea. Another notion of a society is that it's more like an ecosystem. It's more like an ecosystem. So think of a lake as an ecosystem. It has all sorts of different kinds of fish in it. It exists in a terrain. It has a particular climate. There's drainage. There's water sources coming in. It has plants. It's a ecosystem in which all the different components do affect each other, but it isn't really a totality. It's not really a totality. You can introduce an invasive species into the lake, and it most likely will just die off, and some invasive species take over. It's a heterogeneous system with lots of different causal processes that contingently interact with each other, but it doesn't constitute an integrated whole. Well, I think economic systems narrowly and societies more broadly are more like ecosystems. There's something in between. They're what we'd call a loosely coupled system. The metaphor of an ecosystem is a better one than the metaphor of an organism to understand society. And what this means is that when we say that we live in a capitalist society or a capitalist economy, what we really mean is that we live in an economic ecosystem within which capitalism is dominant, but in which all sorts of non-capitalist forms exist alongside it. All kinds of non-capitalist ways of organizing our cooperation for purposes of producing goods and services exists alongside capitalism. Some are effectively complementary to capitalism and help capitalism. They're kind of complements. Others exist independently and are neither here nor there with respect to capitalism. They just kind of do their own thing and have minimal connections. And some may be even contradictory to capitalism. That is, they're irritants. They represent alternative principles which pose potential challenges in the sense of alternative ways of organizing substantial parts of human livelihood, of how people gain their livelihood. So the idea of eroding capitalism then says, okay, we live in a capitalist society that is with an economic structure, an economic ecosystem dominated by capitalism. Let's figure out ways of expanding the non-capitalist forms within that economic ecosystem, and particularly the non-capitalist forms that most embody principles of equality, democracy, and solidarity. Let's use the state to modify rules of the game to enhance the possibilities for such non-capitalist spaces. If it's just left up to its own devices and we just have to navigate this process outside of the state by just doing the best we can in the existing niches where this is possible, it will remain marginal. The only way for a strategy of eroding capitalism to work is to also treat the state as a problem. To treat the state as a target in which we can change rules of the game in ways which expand the possibilities for non-capitalist relations. Just one example of that, I think that the proposals which are currently getting on the table in a serious way for a generous, unconditional basic income those should be really thought of as key proposals for eroding capitalism. I think that's a key part of what this strategy would look like. Because what does giving everybody unconditionally a basic income sufficient to live a decent, no-frills standard of living? What does that mean? It gives everybody the possibility of exiting capitalism. Now, you can exit capitalism and become a surfer, a beach bum, or you can exit capitalism to use your labor and time to build non-capitalist relations. It's essentially a way of transferring surplus from capital accumulation to social accumulation via the initiatives of individuals. So it's an individualistic solution rather than a collective solution. But it's an individualistic solution that allows for collective solutions as people join together to form worker cooperatives, solidarity, and social economy enterprises, all sorts of new forms of building economic relations in which their basic standard of living is uncontingent upon the income that's generated through these alternatives. Well, that is a change in the rules of the game from above, which allow for new initiatives from below. And that's why I think unconditional basic income is one of the key components of a strategy of eroding capitalism. I have three little concluding points. It probably
sounds good.
Okay. All right. So there, just to wrap this up, there are three additional issues that need to be resolved before this is a complete picture. This is just, you know, a point of entry into this terrain. One is, what's the nature of the destination? What are we actually pointing towards? What is the alternative? Second concerns the theory of the state. The whole premise of my combining taming capitalism with escaping and resisting is that the state could be a setting within which this is possible. Can a capitalist state contribute to eroding capitalism? And finally, agency. Well, who are the collective agents for this struggle? That's, of course, a big question. I'm just going to run through this without defending anything. My conception of the destination sees socialism as a radical, heterogeneous economic democracy that involves at least the following components. You replace a market-conforming democracy with a democracy-conforming market. That's a play on a phrase by Angela Merkel, who praises the market-conforming democracy. Expand and deepen the cooperative market economy and the social solidarity economy and the peer-to-peer collaborative economy. These are three non-capitalist forms that already exist within capitalism. All three of these need to be expanded and deepened. Protect the commons and expand the array of publicly provided goods and services, and democratize the corporation. And there's interesting new work on what that means. The capitalist state, I think the central agenda is democratizing democracy to expand the limits of socialist relations within capitalism. I think of the capitalist state, like I think of the capitalist economy, as a kind of ecosystem rather than a totality. It is a capitalist state, meaning the capitalist character of the state dominates the ecosystem, the political ecosystem of our apparatuses of the state. But just like the economy is heterogeneous with fractures and contradictions in different forms, so too is the state, and those can be enhanced. And that's what democratizing democracy means. And finally, agency, I don't really have much to say. This is just a, you know, it's not a very catchy slogan even. Constructing a democratic egalitarian coalition for multi-layered collective action. I mean, give me a break. You know, here's the point. There's no ready-made coherent historical subject capable of acting politically to undermine capitalism. That was the great hope of Marx and of Marxism, was that it had a theory and it was fantastic. And if it were an adequate theory, it would be not just a fantastic construction as an intellectual product, but it would be fantastically useful for actually challenging capitalism. The idea was that capitalism produced a ready-made historical subject capable of overthrowing capitalism by its own inner logic. That work was done by the dynamics of capitalism. All that was left to be done was to make it politically coherent. That's what agency was needed. But you didn't have to assemble the agents, you know, from a heterogeneous set of life circumstances. this, I think, the 21st century doesn't let us do. So the collective agent has to be done through some kind of complex way, which I don't think anyone has really good ideas about. I mean, people have all sorts of practical suggestions for concrete circumstances. But what it means in the big picture sense is vague, like my constructing a democratic egalitarian coalition for multi-layered collective action. But somehow that's what the task entails. Thank you.
Okay, and now we'll have 15 to 20 minutes. Does that sound? Okay, great. For Peter to respond, and then we'll have some time for discussion from the floor before we hand it back to Eric and Peter for some final thoughts.
Yeah, I'd like to first begin with the last question on the agency, because it seems to me that from the current standpoint, the dilemma we face is not choosing which strategy we think might be most effective in ending capitalism. The first dilemma we have, of course, is that in the face of ever eroding conditions for the working classes, you know, for the subaltern classes, there is increasingly less resistance or political potentiality from their standpoint. I mean, we have, of course, in the United States, as wages decrease over time, as unemployment becomes much more precarious and contingent, as the provisions of the welfare state as they existed become ever weaker, we have Donald Trump and other, certainly even worse, developments. But what we don't see is widespread discontent that cannot find the correct strategy for ending capitalism. We have in the United Kingdom, of course, comparable erosions of welfare state protections, and we're on the heels of an election that very likely will result in an increasing of power of the conservative government of the Tories. We have, of course, in my home country, in Greece, on the last 7 or 8 years, a reduction of salaries of around 40%, an unemployment rate of 25%, and there's the occasional demonstration, you know, but there is no serious challenge to the power of the state or any kind of a serious revolutionary movement or social democratic movement or movement to exit. I mean, people try to survive, and some people may move back to the villages to plant, you know, a garden or two. But there is no serious challenge. I think this is, to begin with, we have to take account of the historical conjuncture and the fact that the dilemma today is not choosing the right strategy. It's trying to figure out how in the hell capitalism is able to survive so relatively easily in ever-deteriorating conditions. And this certainly, I think, is a point that has to be addressed in concert with any kind of a desire to talk about what strategies might be able to work. Second point I'd like to make is that to emphasize strategy simply from the standpoint of the attentions of whichever actors may eventually come into existence who desire to end capitalism discounts the importance of the institutional, of course, in historical moments. Because, as we know, revolutionary movements more often than not have ended in reforms as opposed to revolutions. And that was certainly true in the United States with the labor movements and other radical movements in the 1930s. Sometimes reformist movements may end in revolutionary moments. I mean, you know, something even more recent, something like May 68 in France, as we know, began as a movement to desegregate the dormitories so male and female students could have sex and live together in the same dormitories, which then very quickly, of course, escalated and grew to a very different kind of political moment. So we have to take that into account. If we take that into account, the possibilities for reform, the possibilities for whatever action may be taken from the standpoint of those who desire a break from capitalism or to end capitalism seem much more limited than they have been in the recent past. For the primary purpose that if the capitalist state, in the words of Lenin, is the best shell for capitalism, or if the capacity of the capitalist state to engender the extent of reproduction of capitalism to one extent was premised on its capacity to incorporate class struggles from below and modify them, rationalize the economy in ways that dissipated the discontent. So if it is indeed the case, I mean, if we think to something like the upheavals in Detroit in the summer of 1967, which to begin with, from the standpoint of the subjectivity of the people involved, may have been all kinds of things. It's not necessarily, of course, that it was a very organized moment that had as a goal to reform or end capitalism, but it was certainly a political moment. It was certainly an expression of discontent and a desire for something new. When you had 2,000 plus buildings being burned down, it was the largest destruction of property in the United States until Hurricane Katrina. It was a major political action. That itself, of course, was able, the state, in addition to, of course, the police and the FBI and the other tactics they have, was a impetus for certain kinds of reforms, certain efforts to, whether it's increasing public education, higher education, put people into universities so they're less prone to burn down buildings, whatever the tactics may be, that itself led to certain kinds of reforms and being able to incorporate that discontent and rationalize and neutralize it. And if we look at the capacity of the state today, we see that it's much less, much weaker in that regard. It's much more rigid. So the capacity of the state to take popular discontent and translate it into policies and through that neutralize it or help dissipate it is much less than it was before. And that raises the question of the possibility of a radical break, simply because the machinery is much more rigid. It doesn't have the flexibility to do its job in the classical way that Marxist theorists thought the bourgeois state functioned, as a way of rationalizing the economy and class contradictions and incorporating the interests of the dominated within the broader strategies. Then it does raise that question, that it's a much more rigid system, a weaker system, less capable of incorporating demands from below. The problem, of course, as I indicated in the beginning, is that there's no, more and more, we have less potential for collective action from below. So we have, on one level, an increasing potentiality for a radical break with the capitalist present. On the other hand, we have a great erosion of the potentiality for political action from below. And that, I think is the most significant question that we're faced with. What happens? And the political potentialities of the 1930s or 1960s even become unimaginable today. What happens when people are unwilling to take risks? What happens that people are unwilling to engage in any kind of a serious and sustained political activity, even in the face of, as in the case of Greece, very, very significant deteriorations in their conditions of life, very serious uncertainties and economic hardships.
All right. Thank you. So now we have about a half hour for some discussion from the floor. I ask people to keep their comments under about...
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.